example more relevant to the semiotics of material value, in American society, filet mignon is to hamburgers as fine dining is to lunch. Still, as my esteemed colleague Eric Hamp warned in this connection, don't be so sure. For proportions linking distinctions of persons with differences of goods they produce, exchange, or consume are merely shorthand or habitus forms of larger cultural schemes. Following Pierre Bourdieu, they are more or less conscious expressions of greater symbolic orders whose full extent and logic are usually unknown to those who act on them. Operating practically, it is enough for Americans to know this social difference between hamburgers and filet mignon so that they will not buy hamburgers to entertain honored guests. Yet at some level, they must also know that filet mignon is French, even as incorporating an honored guest in a familial meal is analogously the domestication of greater external values. I use this small example of the marked value of difference or alterity, which is to say the market value of alterity, as a point of entry into the big argument of the paper that cross-culturally in all manner of societies, life and death powers are largely situated in transcendent cosmic realms, whence come the objectifications of such otherworldly powers that Marcel Mauss called magical property, goods with the corresponding capacity of ordering and prospering the people who appropriate them. In more familiar terms, these are the valuables or prestige goods of classic ethnographies, the currencies of life-giving, status-endowing, and society-making transactions, as of bride wealth, kula, and potlatch. These are the things that grow children, ally lineages, make chiefs, declare wars, engage sorcerers, and solicit gods. One may thus take as a general principle Viveros de Castro's observation for Tupi Guarani societies that, I quote, the symbolic attributes of positions linked to alterity encompass hierarchically the material dimensions of society. In a similar vein, Rodney Needham developed a broad ethnographic demonstration of what he called the collective localization of the mystical in external forces and beings to whose powers of vitality and mortality societies are inevitably subject. It follows that, ensouled with such forces and beings, the best things come from the cosmic outside, and the best people are those who acquire, possess, and distribute them. We are talking about wealth, the ultimate meaning and value of which is human life. Think of this paper, then, as an exercise in the cosmological economics of human finitude. The results could well challenge some of our own parochial economics. It turns out, for example, that scarcity is generally a function of value rather than the other way around, insofar as the value of riches is a function of their provenience in the external realms on which human existence depends. There follow a few pertinent reports from around the planet, starting again with a modest example from home. For in such regards, we are one of the others. The domestication of difference has a certain prestige value even in quotidian American consumption. Sorry for this running nose. An allergy to New York, yes. Dan Siegel first called my attention to the diurnal sequence of increasing diversity in middle-class American meals, correlated, moreover, to the social value of the commensality. In the morning, people generally eat the same thing day after day from a limited repertoire of distinctive breakfast foods, cereals, eggs, and the like, and often in an individual catch-as-catch-can manner rather than collectively at a familial table. Lunch for most family members is likely to be taken outside the house on working days from a more varied menu, slightly more varied or somewhat more varied, of soups, sandwiches, and salads, and so forth, and in the have friendly acquaintances or colleagues, a slightly more sociable relation than individuality of breakfast. Dinner, by contrast, is paradigmatically a family occasion, thus of the greatest intimacy as well as the highest social value, and is marked by the greatest culinary diversity, not only in relation to entire meals, earlier meals, but from day to day. Hence, the so-called rational choice of shoppers in American supermarkets deciding on the purchase of different meats, poultry, or fish on the arbitrary principle of what they would say having something different from last night's dinner, where difference is determined from a complex typology of main dishes and methods of cooking, such as frying, roasting, boiling, etc. One might even go ethnic for dinner at a Chinese, Brazilian, or Ethiopian restaurant. When I was doing fieldwork in Fiji, the people commented on how bizarre were the European food habits that not only required different foods every day, but different foods three times a day. Still, the Fijian food of the greatest value and the most ritual attention was also foreign, enemy cannibal victims. And the greatest Fijian valuables were, and still are, sperm whale teeth acquired accidentally from beached whales or in external trade with other Pacific Island peoples and in colonial times from passing whaling ships. Used notably in marital and martial alliances, thus as a means of vitality and mortality, whale teeth, as one European observer put it, were considered, quote, the price of a human life. Cooked men, raw women, and whale teeth are what Fijians call great things. Their common fungible value, amounting to a classic sphere of exchange, resides in their common life-giving finalities. Traditionally, cooked men, that is, the cannibal victims, were offered to the chieftain god and brought in this way divine benefits in fertility and prosperity, while raw women were reproductive virgin daughters, and whale teeth were the means of obtaining both of them. Here, then, is a certain relation between alterity and material value by way of reproductive virtues. Consider the like in the report of Sidney Howell on the value of gold for the Leo people of Flores. Originating beyond Leo society, gold is notably acquired in affinal exchanges by wife givers, thus in return for the transfer of women's reproductive powers between patrilineal groups. Not incidentally, this is a common use of foreign-derived wealth from the anthropological world around, which also suggests that the original money uses were social payments and the storage of life values. As Howell relates, life inheres in Flora's gold, not inertly, but as a communicable force. Gold, she writes, is not inanimate. It is imbued with life force, a life force which is as necessary for the recreation of life processes as rice and women. Gold in itself has a potency of a life-promoting kind. I suggest, she says, that there is a conceptual link between red gold, which is the most valuable kind, blood, and women, which together adds to the significance of gold as the vital part of alliance exchanges. Gold and women and rice constitute each other within the semantic domain of the flow of life. End quote. From the native North American West come reports on wealth in dentalium shells obtained from the distant spiritual realms of dentalium land or money's home, to be used likewise in local payments for life powers, particularly bride price and vergo. Bushnell and Bushnell summarized the relevant sources, especially Kroeber on the Yurok. I quote, although men yearned and strove for dentalia, it is clear that this most prized of wealth objects ultimately belonged to the gods and partook of their magical godlike qualities. For the Yurok, Kroeber referred to dentalium land, also translated as dentalian home or money's home, across the ocean at the north of the world where the ceremonial dances never cease. In addition, addition to dentalia, most if not all the other greatly prized and highly valued objects are intimately linked to the world of the immortals and characteristically emit supernatural power that redounds to the good fortune and health of those who possess them. By effecting marital alliances between, that's end quote, by effecting marital alliances between groups, by giving legitimacy and social value to children, by compensating killings, and not least by elevating the standing of men who accumulated it, money was strategically involved in constituting the good order and reproduction of the larger society. This helps explain the recurrent politics of alterity in the ethnographic notices that are considered here, namely the relation between wealth and power established by the way of the heroic appropriation of foreign things endowed with animate forces of life and death. As among Yurok, Hoopa, and other Aboriginal California groups, such feats of daring do involving the capture of existential powers from abroad marked the achievement of authority even in the absence of chiefs and kings. Or again, for something not completely different, in the Pacific, the complex monies of Palau, consisting of beads and bracelet segments of various colors, shapes, and composition, all of foreign provenience, ultimately derived from India, China, Malaya, or the Philippines. These monies were brought by voyagers at least several hundred years ago, albeit the Palauan viewed their origin rather more marvelously. As Richard Parmentier observes, I quote, "There is an important connection in Palau, as elsewhere in the Austronesian world, between the notion of foreign provenience and the idea of sacred power," end quote. Continuing even into modern times, he says, "Foreigners bringing money, firearms, and new religions are next to the god," like Captain Cook, for example. Hence, by long tradition, money is of foreign, celestial, or magical origin, coming from distant lands, from the eyes of the gods in the heaven, or from magical fish from the depths of the sea. Especially money comes from the heavens, but in Parmentier's persuasive analysis, the significant point is its situation in a decidedly non-historical locus, in that way reinforcing its transcendental quality, and thereby making the system of rank resistant to contingency. Here again, money is engaged in the construction of the greater order of society, commonly in the transactions by which husbands compensate their wives' matrilines for the food and services the women provide, and importantly in the elite circulation and or sequestration of higher value monies among chiefs. Hence Parmentier's observation that, quote, "money is a creative diagram of Palau's hierarchical social system." His argument is that while the Palauan social system, like any other, is subject to contingent fluctuations in the conditions of its reproduction, money anchors this process, quote, "in being both the sedimented embodiment of accomplished power and the transactional mechanism for its attainment. By monopolizing the exchange of tokens of high value, whose origins lie in celestial and natural forces, title holders in the centuries before Western contact reinforced their privilege with sacred, foreign, and magical authority. The Manambu of the Middle Sepik region of New Guinea, regard their purchase of rituals, myth, and cult objects from their Iyatmo neighbors as no less powerful, since, as Simon Harrison recounts, and I quote, in very many ways, the Manambu implicitly associate the Iyatmo with the invisible world of spirits," end quote. Even Iyatmo words figure significantly in speech registers of Manambu ceremony and myth-telling. For to them, to their ears, I quote, "the Iyatmo language is entirely invocative of the whole conceived world of myth and totemic cosmology," end quote. Thanks. approach them other than the hereditary leaders of the men's cult in whose houses they are kept. These most potent objects are the large decorated clay pots in which Iyatmo women daily make their cooking fires. The mundane, feminine, and foreign associations of these sacred pots might seem incongruous were it not that to the Manambu, as Harrison writes, they are potent symbols of the female powers of feeding and nurturance which men arrogate to themselves in ritual, and they are so because they are specifically Iyatmo symbols of these powers. Note the ambivalence in the relation to foreign valuables, at once life-giving and life-threatening, a condition of the alternation between raid and trade that marks Manambu-Iyatmo relations in general. Just so it is the dangerous potency of things Iyatmo that makes them so desirable. To the Manambu, writes Harrison, the cultural forms of the Iyatmo are surrounded by an aura of especially dangerous power and therefore valuable to acquire. No doubt the desirability consists in part in the implication of triumph over life-giving and death-dealing spiritual forces embodied in the Iyatmo cultural practices. But the question remains of why these are dangerous. For the Manambu, and many analogous cases in Melanesia, Amazonia, and elsewhere, I believe it is necessary to take the animism of these exchanges seriously. More on this animism presently, but here it is to be noted that the appropriation of foreign valuables from nearby peoples amounts to the invasion of foreign beings. The seeming contradictions may go so far as to combine the appropriation of foreign identity with enmity and ethnocentricity. The cult houses of the Manambu were constructed very similarly to the Iyatmo cult houses, but in a slightly different style. For they claimed, Manambu claimed they would die if they built their cult houses just like those of Iyatmo. Combining diffusion with opposition, here is a Melanesian case of the narcissism of minor differences. In an article on the commerce of cultures in Melanesia that speaks to the widespread exchange of cultural forms in the region, and specifically to the transactions and rituals that convey what he calls surrogate human beings and living force, Harrison observes that an alien gift was a gift of power, potentiating the group receiving it. Indeed, some Melanesian people seem to regard the efficacy of rituals as tending to increase in proportion to the foreignness of their provenience. This helps explain a phenomenon of a kind Harrison came across in his own Manambu fieldwork and is often remarked elsewhere under the heading of acculturation, namely, the indigenization of colonial power. He tells of a certain Manambu subclan that some years back claimed European clothes as its totem on the basis of a purported mythological connection with the local colonial administrators. Thereupon, he writes, this bid for prestige provoked the main political rival of that clan to claim totemic ownership of the queen. Here was a classic stroke of complementary schismogenesis, to go back to the Anatmo, involving a move outside and above society in order to make an invidious contrast with a competitor within it. And that was followed by the competitor's equally practiced riposte of symmetrical schismogenesis, aimed at downing his rival by doing more and better of the same. If you have a colonial administrator, I have the queen. In the same way as Melanesian clans fashioned totems out of the colonial encounter, the advent of Europeans radically changed the cosmography of power for Tikopeans, expanding both the range and variety of talismanic goods and experiences. As Raymond Firth related, a great outburst of overseas voyaging, or as the Tikopeans called it, traveling around the sky, because you live in an island. vision of the new worlds that lay beyond the horizon and the exciting experiences offered by contact with Europeans there, end quote. The disastrous effects were numerous deaths at sea. Well over 100 men in the few generations before Firth's 1929 fieldwork, when the population was 1,298, and another 80 men in 30 voyages after 1929. A popular song tells what was at stake, valuables from abroad. The lyrics go, we hear, great is the greed of our eyes for valuables from abroad which come with disaster. Stephen U. Jones writes in a familiar vein of the desires of European goods by the Barasana people of Colombia, arguing that these desires were not simply forced upon them by white men. On the contrary, for the Barasana, European manufactured things are imbued with a power they call Eva, and I quote, an irresistible, attractive, and potent force which leads them to act in an uncontrolled manner and to do things against their better judgment, end quote. Guns, clothes, and the other manufactures created by the extraordinary shaman and other manufacturers were created by the extraordinary shamanic powers of the ancestral father of the white people, one Waribi. They now come from spirits in the world of the dead, which the Barasana represent in myth as Sydney, America, and Auckland. London, America, and Sydney. To possess those goods, says Hugh Jones, is to share in the world from which they derive and to appropriate some of the transformational power that is used to make them. The differences notwithstanding, many African societies were likewise concerned to domesticate and incorporate powerful external beings, forces, and things. Nor is it unusual that these exotica were dangerous. Michael Rowland speaks of the royal realms of the Cameroon grasslands in the following terms. The ideal of a closed and involuted society, spatially represented in dense settlements behind massive defense works, on further examination reveals a reality of external dependency and exchange with power itself as a foreign substance which could serve to tear society asunder. If the outside is the source of all evil, then logically it was this external arena which had to be brought within the bounds of moral order. Warfare, formal alliances, gift exchange, intermarriage, and the diffusion of royal regalia were all elements of a single strategy to achieve this end. The interregional hierarchy of rulers was crucial both for facilitating profitable trading and for acquiring the symbolic materials necessary to maintain social order. Perhaps these reports of traffic in foreign goods embodying otherworldly powers are sufficient to demonstrate the extent of the practice. For the phenomenon is indeed general. I have not even mentioned many other well-known examples. The stone money of Yap, the wampum of Eastern North America, the bronze gongs and drums of Southeast Asia, the shell, cloth, iron, and brass monies of Equatorial Africa, the red feather money of Santa Cruz. In any case, it would be easy to add more of the same, thanks to a remarkable series of works by Mary Helms, filled with scores of ethnographic and historical examples from around the planet, especially her book Craft and the Kingly Ideal, which is a long demonstration of the thesis that kingship is, quote, associated with distant, power-filled spaces that carry ancestral and godly connotations, and the acquisition from this outside world of valued resources beneficial for society at home that will also enhance kingly fame, glory, and authority. Here, indeed, is the whole political economy of alterity. Those who create or acquire goods and benefits from some dimension invention of the cosmological outside, she writes, are not only providing goods and benefits, but also are presenting tangible evidence that they themselves possess or command the unique qualities and ideals generally expected in persons who have ties with distant places of supernatural origins and therefore are themselves second creators. The question that remains is why these vital powers inherit in otherness, which is also the question of why the material goods of the highest value, variously described as monies, valuables, prestige goods, treasures, wealth, or riches, originate in the cosmological outside. Durkheim made some headway toward a solution of the riches problem when he noted, or rather footnoted, that, quote, economic value is a sort of power, and we know the religious origins of the idea of power, end quote. But if Durkheim got no further than with this insight, it was probably because he had already identified religion with the power of society, thus directing attention internally, whereas what was at issue was the economic, spiritual value of foreign objects. It was left to Mohs to augment the argument, not only by his golden analysis of the animate qualities of the gift, but by his explicit general observation of the divine origins of riches. I quote, among the first group of beings with whom men must have made contracts were the spirits of the dead and the gods. They are, in fact, the real owners of the world's wealth. With them, in particular, it is necessary to exchange, end quote. All of which leads to the satisfactory sequitur, to the effect that the alterity of material value resides in the spiritual value of alterity. In ways all too broad and banal, I claim that riches, being largely valued for their otherness, have their ultimate source in human finitude. Lack of control over the fundamental conditions of life and death is the reason for a radical construction of difference, the transcendence and incorporation of which thus creates an always heteronomous society. In this connection, it's interesting that we, your anthropology started off, thanks to Herder and company, with this complete fixation on internal relations, an explanation from, I don't know, economic basis, functional relation, all of them internal, but there is no society that's all alone, and no society that isn't constituted heteronomously by its relation to others. In this connection, I have more than once cited Viveros de Castro's account of the Amazonian Arawete. I quote, if humans were immortal, perhaps society would be confounded with the cosmos. But since death exists, it is necessary for society to be linked with something that is outside itself, from which death comes, and that it be linked socially to this exterior so that it can be controlled. Moreover, it is not only death, but life, health, and the natural conditions of prosperity that are beyond the powers of human agency, and so destined society to be linked to more than human potencies outside itself, hence magically then, as well as socially. And of course, materially, that's the point of the essay. Ranging from beasts, spirits, and gods to the ineffable forces of mana or manitou, by way of the ancestors or other peoples with their remarkable gifts, the extraordinary agents that govern the human fate live outside the space of human governance. More precisely, the lack of control translates as being in other space. The proposition is, as I say, banal. One is reminded of Malinowski's observation that magic comes into play in Trobriand fishing, gardening, and canoe construction, where technological capacities leave off. Magic is practiced in dangerous deep-sea fishing as opposed to netting fish within the reef, or it appears in connection with so-called agencies and forces that one year bestow good crops and another year bad weather and noxious insects. Or again, in overseas voyaging, since for all the Trobriand skills in canoe infrastructure and navigation. They remain, quote, at the mercy of powerful and incalculable tides, sudden gales, and unknown reefs. Ignore for the present purposes the usual distinctions of magic and religion. The proposition is that people must depend for their own existence on external conditions, not of their making, hence and whence their notions of otherworldly powers. Nothing foreign is merely human to them. The going anthropological alternative is that divinity is a misrecognition of humanity. For Durkheim, God is a misplaced conception of the power of society, which people experience but know not its true source. For a certain Marxist anthropology, God is an alienated projection of people's own capacities of production and reproduction, an unhappy consciousness that has transferred human self-fashioning to the deity. Yet all such notions of misrecognition do not tell us why society is set in a cosmos of beings invested with powers of vitality and mortality beyond any that humans affect, know, or control, produce, or reproduce. These ideas of false consciousness do not take account of the generic predicament of the human condition, this dependence on generic forces of life and death that are neither created by human science nor governed by human intentionality. If people were really in control of their own existence, they would not die or fall ill. Nor do they control the biological workings of agricultural or sexual generation, or the weather on which their prosperity depends, or, notably for the present argument, the other peoples of their kin, people whose own mode of existence may be enviable or scandalous to them, but in any case, by their very difference from themselves, strangers who offer a transcendent capacity for life. On the west coast of New Guinea, the marriage ceremonies of Biak Islanders, at these ceremonies, the bride appears in procession to her husband's house as an ambulatory icon of foreign value, adorned with crisp bank bills in her hair, silver bracelets on her wrists, and layers of newly purchased cloth on her body. Besides, the bride's people bring an array of foreign wealth, including antique porcelain from China, Europe, and Japan, more silver bracelets forged from colonial coins, store-bought plates, textiles, and cash. Later, when the brother of the bride bestows foreign valuables through her to her children, these things will distinguish the children as individuals of talent, value, and reproductive virtue, and perhaps even put them in the honored status of foreigner, amber, a title usually attributed to the Biak elite of pastors, civil servants, and village chiefs. In olden times, prominent Biak could affect titles bestowed by the Sultan of Tidore in the Moluccas, one of the signs and means of power they acquired in adventurous voyages of raid and trade, ostensibly bringing tribute to the Sultan, but returning with foreign valuables that testify to their own prowess. At least as important as the cloth, beads, porcelain, and other wealth bestowed by the Sultan was the barak they absorbed from being in his presence, the Islamic Arabic version of an Indonesian visible power. The Malay term is semengat, which is akin to mana. Returning home, the voyagers conveyed this potency by handshakes with their relatives, who promptly rubbed it on their faces. In her brilliant ethnography of all this, Raiding the Land of the Foreigners, Denylan Rutherford writes of Tidore, quote, "This distant place provided the currency of value, both in its functions, in both its functions, in the form of objects that represent a person's past achievement, and in the form of an invisible substance that conveyed the capacity to act." If the beings and forces of the outside thus hierarchically encompass the material dimensions of society, it follows again that authority is based on the appropriation of alteration. vision quests through trade and plunder, headhunting and cannibalism to stranger kings whose cosmocratic powers bring fertility and prosperity to the indigenous agriculturalists. In this connection of stranger kings, recall Michael Rowland's observation on the acquisition of external means of internal order by the rulers of Cameroon grassland polities. Many of these are stranger king formations. Indeed, Rowland's summary of the foundational charters of Bamako chiefdoms offers a classic stranger king tradition of the kind that could be duplicated in narratives from medieval Ireland to the Fiji Islands, not to mention many other African societies or the great New World states of Aztec, Maya, and Inca all had stranger dynasties. The dynastic founding ancestor, writes Rowland, is always an immigrant who has left another established chiefdom after a quarrel over succession. He is an accomplished hunter, note the association with the forest and sorcery, who comes to a place where the indigenous population are farmers and their chiefs own the land and ensure agricultural success. The immigrant hunter establishes himself through gifts of wild game and takes local women as wives and counter gifts. He attracts people to him through his generosity and finally, by a ruse, drives out the indigenous chiefs or converts them into sub-chief status. I have elsewhere discussed at length on the structure of these dual polities of foreign rulers and indigenous owners. And I don't want to depend here too much on the kingness of strangers. Of concern here is the paradigmatic association of sovereignty with the provision of prestigious goods of foreign provenience. The stranger king, in one way or another, is a rainmaker, both in the Fraserian sense that he fertilizes the bearing earth of the Aboriginal people, and in the colloquial sense that, our own colloquial sense, that by contrast to their identification with the land, he is a main source of society's magical properties, its mobile and transmissible wealth or money forms, including the life-enhancing foreign valuables distributed in kingly largesse or manipulated as royal regalia. As it is said in the famous annals of Malacca in the Malay Peninsula, the Sejarah Melayu, where there is sovereignty, there is gold. In fact, Rupert Brooke, when he became the Raja of Sarawak, used to distribute gold dust to the Iban, who took it home and threw it on their fields because it increased the fertility of the field. You would call this a fetishism, but what's gold? Which has just as much magical efficacy as throwing it on the fields. Providing foreign wealth and richly fertilizing the land, of course, are parallel sovereign functions inasmuch as both convey the vitality of alterity and comprise a necessary complement of active means for realizing the fixed earthly powers of the indigenous people. Indeed, at the minimum, you could say, for example, of the Shaluk king or the Lovadu rain king, that the king reigns but does not govern. R-A-I-N-S. Yet stranger kingship is only a developed political form of the acquisition of external life powers. In such respects, headhunting is as much the same thing, if in reverse, and you'll have to read the printed version to get that because I'm going to skip it in the interest of time. There is one thing, however, about headhunting that I would mention, and that is that Ivan, whom I just referred to, in their famous journeys as young men, as they're called, Bajalai, to acquire heads in old times and for trade in modern times, these journeys gave them the ability to marry, that is, gave them reproductive powers and through the heads they captured. But as early as the middle of the 19th century, they began to substitute Chinese jars, big Chinese jars, which they also captured or traded for, said of the Ivan of Sarawak that young men could not marry until they had taken a head, but in the 19th century accounts already indicated that acquiring heirloom wealth in the form of large Chinese jars during the Bay July was an acceptable substitute. Obtained violently by piracy or peacefully by trade, the jars could be equivalent to the heads, insofar as they had analogous qualities of external subjectivity and agency. The historian John Walker explains in terms that Marcel Mauss could have used, many of the goods obtained through Bay July were themselves sources of potency. Antique jars, for example, were credited with supernatural powers and healing virtues and could thereby contribute to the potency of the community to which they were taken. Moreover, the successful accumulation of prestige goods and other wealth could indicate in itself an increase in spiritual powers, status, and strength, end quote. Animated by the transcendent potencies of far-off beings, here is a kind of magical property that for Marcel Mauss was the origin of money. True that Mauss did not recognize the consistent externality of so-called primitive money forms. But then he was spared the evident error in the common scholarly myth that money originated as a convenient means of external trade, inasmuch as it was presumed to be incompatible with kinship society. For on the one hand, as already noted of Ibon, foreign wealth may be as well acquired by predation as by exchange. And on the other hand, money is not necessarily contradictory to kinship order, as Jonathan Perry and Maurice Bloch have effectively argued. On the contrary, they say, where the economy is embedded in society and subject to its moral laws, monetary relations are rather unlikely to be represented as the antithesis of bonds of kinship and friendship, and there is consequently nothing inappropriate about making gifts of money to cement such bonds, end quote. All the more so insofar as the gift conveys the being of the giver, thus is in effect kinship itself, a mutuality of being. Indeed, such compatibility of money and kinship was already presupposed in Moses' treatment of exchange, of the exchange of treasures. In this regard, three aspects of Moses' reflections on riches seem to me still fundamental and credible. First, such riches, as he said, have a mystical value and are talismans or life givers. Mauss made the point particularly in respect of Northwest Coast valuables. Each of these precious things, he wrote, has a productive capacity within it. Each, as well as being a sign and surety of life, is also a sign and surety of wealth, a magical religious guarantee of rank and prosperity. Secondly, these life-giving powers are not extra economic complements of material value. They are the material value. Mauss notably made the point, the Durkheimian point, that the indigenous monies are identified with spiritual forces. For the Iroquois, he wrote, money is called arenda, or for the Algonquins, manitu. Among the Sioux, wakan. Throughout Polynesia, it is called mana. Therefore, the question is decided, end quote. Or, if still undecided, consider the ethnographic report that, quote, wampum did not command regard because it was used as money. It was used as money because for other reasons it already commanded regard. Thirdly, rather than a disruption of kinship order of these societies, such riches are means of their construction. More than merely compatible with kinship relations, money is often the necessary condition of kinship. Used to effect alliances, compensate injuries, and establish hierarchies, the life-giving valuables thereby constitute and extend sociability, an aspect of money that only lately has been emphasized by Keith Hart. Especially as we have seen, the larger organization of society is constructed through the disposition of foreign valuables, as in the payments of marital and military alliance, or the appropriations and distributions of wealth that constitute rank and rule, in potlatch, for example. Here is a testimony to an observation recently emphasized in Melanesian and Amazonian societies the effect that society itself is found on otherness, founded on otherness. Affirming the statement of a fellow ethnographer of a Pano or Amazonian people, Philip Erickson says, quote, the internal social order requires the incorporation of the powers of the society of others. And this is not only true, he says, for all Pano groups, but one can go even further, however, I'm quoting, and affirm that the stranger is not only perceived as a sort of reservoir of brute power that needs to be socialized or mastered for therapeutic or mystical ends, but he is more precisely defined as the model, if not the guarantee, of the constructive virtues of society. One thus understands why the Inca, the hyperbolic model of the stranger for the Pano, appears in most mythologies of the Pano as the culture hero from whom everything was learned, including how to ornament oneself, which is as much to say how to determine one's identity. Otherness may be an internal value in another way, as it were in the relative form of opposition in kind or in dissent between groups of the same society that ensures their solidarity by way of complementarity. Consider Levi-Strauss's celebrated analysis of the so-called totemism as a mode of representing and comprehending the differences between social groups by the differences between species respectively associated with them. Clan A is to Clan B as, say, eagle hawks, hunters of meat, are to crows, stealers of meat. Levi-Strauss does not always emphasize it, insofar as he insists on the classificatory nature of the so-called totemism. But it is striking that persons or groups belonging to the same society should be as radically distinguished from one another as different natural species. And all the more so when, as is commonly the case, these groups are related to their respective species by common substance. So they are substantially different species in the same society. More exactly, as Levi-Strauss does recognize, the totem groups are often quite the same as well as radically different from each other, the way meat hunters are the same and different from meat stealers. Hence the conclusion that, quote, totemism is thus reduced to a particular fashion of formulating a general problem, to which how to make opposition, instead of being an obstacle to integration, serve rather to produce it. But how to make opposition? Opposition as a cultural intention, not as a simple natural differentiation. Or, supposing the process is something like a cultural speciation, as Ted Schwartz once put it, perhaps one should say how to create complementary opposition as a means of integration. In any event, for some people, such as Australian Aboriginals, from whom the eagle hawk and crow example comes, the effect is a magical practical division of labor and exchange, insofar as each group is responsible for the fertility of its totem, which, however, it is prohibited from eating. Then again, to return momentarily to the Manambu of New Guinea, take the animism into account, as Simon Harrison does. I quote, there is a strong notion of consubstantiality between people and their totems, an idea that in allowing one another the use of their totemic resources, they nourish each other with their own flesh. People often say, for instance, that when they eat yams, they are eating human flesh and blood. In offering one another their resources, they represent themselves as giving away a part of their own substance, an aspect of their own identity. End quote. Here, in the still relevant totemism, is a major clue to a mode of production and exchange, often enough reported ethnographically, although it makes no utilitarian sense in terms of opportunity costs, or no more sense than the incest taboo, which is likewise an arbitrary restriction of autonomy, men foregoing their sisters or daughters, women their brothers or sons, in favor of the acquisition of external life forces. Indeed, I think the incest taboo developed just for that reason. The the same or neighboring societies in the mutual transfer of objectified life powers of alterity. Commenting on the specialized productions of different tribes or exogamous groups in the Vopes regions of northwestern Amazonia, Stephen U. Jones indeed cannot decide whether the diversity is, as it were, economic or totemic in origin. While the Tucano were known for their wooden stools, the Desana for certain baskets, the Tuyuca for canoes, and other peoples for still other things, U. Jones allows that, quote, whether this specialization was once part of a formalized system of intertribal trade, or whether it is simply a part of a wider totemic system that allocated such things as language or varieties of cultivated plants between different groups, is now hard to tell, end quote. Felipe de Scola provides an excellent Amazonian example, wherein the specialization of trade goods derives from the value of the foreign as such, rather than from local possibilities or advantages of production. People prefer to trade for certain things that they could just as well produce themselves. The Eshuar have a marked preference for foreign hunting dogs, for which they are prepared to give things of great value, although these dogs are not especially distinguished from their own. This circulation of hounds, observes Descola, cannot be justified objectively by the quality of the animals obtained from distant places. Rather, as is true of all Hebrew groups, the reason lies in, quote, the fantastical value set on certain material or immaterial things, shamanistic powers, for example, upon which a foreign origin is supposed to confer strength and qualities far superior from those that are obtainable locally. Writing of the Admiralty Islands, Theodore Schwartz felicitously calls the phenomenon cultural totemism, noting its production as a mode of specialization. Noting the production of these differences as a mode of speciation by a process of schismogenesis. On the material plane, moreover, he highlights what he calls the secondary specialization of the kind commonly reported in Melanesia, whereby certain persons or groups have exclusive claims to produce important goods that in many cases could have been produced by others, who have thus been rendered dependent on them. Such ecologically arbitrary specializations in the admiralties include pottery making, fishnet making, shell beads used as currency in Athenian exchanges, and carved and decorated utensils, beds, dance platforms, and other things. It is as if the creation and integration of difference, and thus transcultural exchange, were a necessary condition of the existence of all concerned. In a similar connection, Maurice Godelier makes a general and critical point that whereas the goods of highest value and the greatest competitive interest are scarce in proportion, the scarcity itself may be artificial, he says. Speaking of shells brought from distant places, pig's teeth grown in special shapes, Russell Island money and Northwest Coast coppers, Godelier writes, one could analyze, theoretically, the existence of scarcities that seem to be artificial in certain societies. Everything happens as though society had instituted a scarcity by choosing unusual objects for certain exchanges, end quote. Insofar as the values in question necessarily embody the potencies of foreign being, the societies traditionally known to anthropology indeed subvert a major principle of market economics. For it follows that here scarcity is a function of value, rather than value of scarcity. Nor is the value of these monies or riches fixed by exchange. Clearly, it is not that the value of a thing is exactly what it will bring. Rather than developing from the terms of exchange, the locus of long-distance goods